Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, you're listening to The Future of Media Explained with me, Press Gazette Editor-in-Chief Dominic Ponsford. And this week, we're learning all about how to build a podcast from scratch. Joining me on the Future of Media sofa, I have Press Gazette Associate Editor Will Turville.
Hello, Dom.
Hey, Will. And first of all, I'd like to apologise because I know you wanted to call this the podcast on podcasts, but I'm afraid we're...
Podcast, yeah.
Yeah, I'm afraid that ship sailed.
Yeah, we did another one, didn't we? Yeah. At least another one.
The other thing I need to say to you is why couldn't we do this at the beginning of the run? This is what we need to know, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, we should have done.
But it's not too late. It's not too late. And we're always learning. So who have we got on as our expert witness this week?
Andrew Harrison, who is the co-founder and boss, who is the boss of Podmasters.
And what are Podmasters?
What are Podmasters? Podmasters is an independent podcast production company that makes shows including Oh God, What Now?, which was previously called Romaniacs, and The Bunker. And actually, full disclosure, the reason I came into this podcast was because I recently appeared on The Bunker and I met Andrew Harrison, who wasn't interviewing me but was in the office, and got chatting with him. And I said, oh, you should definitely come onto our podcast because I think I learned a lot and I thought our listeners could learn a lot as well.
Cool. I know from what you've told me about the interview so far, we are going to learn a lot of useful stuff. So brilliant. But before we get onto that, let's just find out, what do we know? What do we know about podcasts? Shall I start or do you want to start?
I'd be interested to know, actually, what is your favourite podcast? You actually revealed this last week. The rest is history. Have you got any others?
Okay, I'll get on to that. I feel that we know quite a lot about podcasts. Not least, we've been doing one now for more than 6 months. But we've been writing a lot about podcasts on Press Gazette in the last 6 months. Definitely more than we've ever done before. And I think the things we know include the following. Podcasts was the area that publishers said they were most likely to invest in this year in a Reuters Institute survey of 300 media leaders, which they did at the end of last year. So it's one of our big themes for the year, podcasts, along with newsletters and paywalls. We know that numerous publishers have got seriously big podcast audiences now. I'm thinking the Telegraph Ukraine podcast, 16 million listens so far. The News Agents, which is global, big sort of star-studded daily news podcast, 10 million listens, 10 million downloads. So they're getting some seriously big audiences. And the other thing I feel I know is that podcasts seem to be becoming quite lucrative for publishers in the sense that Tortoise, the slow news publisher, which launched a few years ago, they said they mainly do podcasts now, and they said their podcast wing is profitable. And I know that Global, the radio company, are investing a huge amount in podcasts because they see that as a good way to make money. And then the final thing I'm going to say about podcasts is I think the reason they work for publishers is that they give you a similar level of engagement to print, in a sense you're getting someone for a good 20, 30 minutes. And they work quite well commercially because you know who the person is often, especially if they've logged in to your player as they do with the global player. And it's quite a good opportunity to advertise to them because they're fully engaged in what's going on. Is that fair?
I think that's all fair. I would call you out on the newsagent's figure. The 10 million figure was actually from December, and the latest is 24 million downloads since they launched in September last year. So just to add to that, I think that's a really good summary of why podcasts are exciting and an area of investment for news publishers. I would add that maybe another reason they're quite a good area to invest in is because they're quite a cheap area to invest in. That's fair to say. I think lots of people say that, you know, you can launch podcasts without too much investment compared with, say, if you were launching, I don't know, a website from scratch and you wanted to make it a very professional, good website. So yeah, I think that's part of it as well. And I'd say as a journalist and someone who enjoys journalizing, which is a word I use, they offer an exciting new medium on which you can be creative and do some really interesting stuff. And there seems to be, it's exciting, isn't it, when there's an area of the journalism sector that's growing and that there's lots of investment, lots of opportunities, lots of new jobs coming up. So yeah, it's great to see this area flourishing at the moment.
The other thing I've written down is smart speakers, because they kind of dovetail quite nicely with that other new technology, don't they? In the sense that I can go into my kitchen and ask my smart speaker to play the latest newsagent's podcast. So it gets us onto smart speakers. It also gets us onto different platforms as well. It helps us grow audience, because like this podcast is on all the various podcast outlets you can think of, Audible.
Except for BBC Sounds.
Yes. I think we get onto that later, don't we? So let's get into it. I guess lots of listeners will be thinking, great, let's launch a podcast. It's a good thing to do. I'm sold. How do you build an audience, build a podcast from scratch, especially when it's such a crowded market, because people have got lots of podcasts they listen to now, haven't they? I know I do.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I wanted to ask Andrew Harrison about, because as I said, he and his co-founder launched this podcast, Romaniacs, fun story, this will probably be the headline of the piece on Press Gazette, he launched it using his PPI compensation money. And that's how he was able to launch it and just give it a bit of a go. So he launched it in 2017, roughly more than 6 months after the EU referendum. He was obviously, as the name suggests, a Romaniac, as were the other people who were involved in it. It proved a massive success. And yeah, it's a dream, isn't it, that you just do something fun and then all of a sudden you're doing well and you've made a business out of it. And now he's got all of these other shows. So it's a really interesting story, and hopefully lots of our listeners will be able to listen to it and be inspired by Andrew Harrison's story.
Brilliant. Let's get into the interview then. Let's hear what he had to say. How did you kick it off?
I kicked it off by just asking him to explain a little bit about him. So he's a former music magazine journalist, and I was interested to know how he transitioned from music magazine journalist into a man running an independent podcast business.
I got started in music magazines, which is always my dream. Ever since I was a little child, I always wanted to be a journalist, and music was my thing, and I always wanted to write for the music press. And luckily enough, just as I was finishing university in Leeds, the kind of post-Q magazine boom was happening. So I pretty much finished my finals on the Friday, and on the Monday was on a plane to San Francisco to interview UB40 for Select magazine, which was launching, which I became the editor of. And I had a long and very fun time in music magazines, edited Q magazine twice, Mixmag twice, worked on the Word magazine with Mark Ellen and Dave Hepworth, who had founded Q and founded Mojo. But the whole sector, as you'll be well aware, just kind of rose and fell, and I felt like I'd been there almost the entire history of the Colour Monthly magazine. And by the early 2000s, I was editing Q for a second time. It was just really very apparent that this sector didn't really have a future. And we had a bit of a parting of the ways, as I was working with a very good team who were doing their absolute utmost to keep Q afloat, but it was the writing was on the wall. And at Q, one of the guys on the business side was Martin Botosh, who's now my business partner in Podmasters. And we always said, whatever happens, we'll work together on something or other. And we just experimented with podcasts in the mid-2010s. We launched a pop culture podcast called Big Mouth, which was tremendous fun. Didn't really get very many listens, but it enabled us to find our way around podcasting. What made it work? What were the dynamics? How to physically do it? How to turn the kind of ideas that I would have for print into an audio proposition? And we decided that we needed something alongside it. It ought to contrast but have a similar feel to Big Mouth. and it ought to be about something we were all obsessed with, and that thing was Brexit. So we launched, on a whim, Romaniacs, with Ian Dunst and Doreen Linsky and Naomi Smith and Ross Taylor and then Alex Andreou. And we were amazed at how quickly it took off. We had 10,000 listens within a week, 20,000. And before long, we were doing about 40 to 50,000 on a weekly podcast purely about how dreadful Brexit was. And it was, I think we found a way of providing the catharsis for an awful lot of people who were not hearing that anywhere else. The major thing that they would talk about was the kind of fake balance that was imposed upon most media by Ofcom rules. You have to balance the argument. And there was nobody able, legally able, to tell the truth as these listeners saw it. So that was the kind of making of us. We built this thing up to, we had a couple of editions, did 100,000 plays. We interviewed Tony Blair and Nick Clegg, and but also brought in really fun people as well, like Al Murray and Mark Gatiss and Chris Addison. Basically, if you were a Romaniac, you were interested in us and we were interested in you. And it was become the centerpiece of the business. We rebranded it because obviously can't remain in the EU anymore. We've left the EU. So we racked our brains and we changed the name to Oh God, What Now? Because that seemed to sum up the spirit of the times. And then around that, we've launched lots of other podcasts. We've got a daily political explainer called The Bunker, where we just go into one item on a kind of 20-minute deep dive. We have a documentary series called Doomsday Watch with Arthur Snell, who is a former diplomat who has, he's been across the world in points and kind of flashpoints, border areas, and he looks at the threats to global civility and global peace that maybe don't get the attention they ought to get. We also do co-productions with Steve Richards' Rock and Roll Politics, Origin Story with Ian Dunst and Doreen Linsky. So we have a kind of really big mixed business, and I'm really glad that we've been able to recruit a lot of people. We've got recruited a lot of young audio professionals, some of them in their first job. And it, to me, it feels like we're able to give the same shot to these people that I got in 1990, when there was no particularly good reason to give me a job, but I got a chance and it worked out. And we've managed to assemble a pretty talented young team. And I'm like, I'm now the old guy in the room, which is quite fun.
When exactly did you launch Romaniacs?
Romaniacs was launched in 2017, which you might think is a little bit late. Perhaps if we'd launched it 18 months earlier, we would have prevented Brexit. We didn't really have the... You can't see the future. It felt that the trajectory of British politics had bent so closely towards the crazy that you just needed something that could express that frustration and that kind of anger. And when we set it up, we said to the core panelists, which is Doreen, Ian, and Peter Collins, who was part of the early team, we'll pay you when we can pay you. It really was one of those things, because we had no idea whether we'd get zero listeners. It might have been me and Andrew Adonis, and that was it, listening to the podcast. But very quickly, we were able to not just accrue money, the standard advertising routes, but we launched a Patreon, a crowdfunder, where we essentially say to the listeners, if you like the podcast, you'll always be able to listen to it for free. It's never going to be paid, never going to be charged for. But if you like us, you want to give us £3 a month, we'd really appreciate it. You want to give us £5 a month, we'll really appreciate it. And we'll send you a coffee mug. £10 a month, all that and a T-shirt. And people really bought into it. We've had fantastic response. And the Patreon people have been the core of what we've done. And we have launched Patreons around all of our other podcasts. People can support the one that they like. We've also just recently launched an all-you-can-eat super subscription on Apple. So if you go to Apple Podcasts, for a single fee, you can get all of our podcasts early with no ads, all benefits there through the Apple Podcast app. So we found that there are lots of diverse ways of funding it. We also do live shows. And during the pandemic, we did live streams, which were great. So you got to see the panelists sitting at home in whatever ratty T-shirt they had lying around. It's interesting to think about Patreon is that you are both building a revenue stream, but you're also building a community. So the stuff that people often find hard to do, we've built a community over here through social media, and we've built revenue streams over here through advertising or sponsorship. Because they're brought together, you've got something that is simultaneously a conduit to your core, most passionate listeners, a way for them not so much to be charged for it as to support it. They like backing us, and that's great. That's a really good feeling. And you've got a way to communicate with them as well. So we found it's really fitted the podcast model very well. And also, we can do exclusive editions for them and things like that.
You also sell merch.
We do merch, yes. People like our merch. Somebody tweeted they'd got the full set of the mugs, and we're like, okay, we'll see on Antiques Roadshow in the year 2080 when this is when whatever generation clone Fiona Bruce is saying that's quite a lot of money that. So yeah, that and the t-shirts. It's been really fun. It's particularly fun when I go to say Glastonbury or Latitude, and you will occasionally see an Oh God What Now t-shirt or a Romaniacs t-shirt. Oh, there you go.
And so were you all in straight away when you launched Romaniacs, or did you have to wait to see yourself whether it was going to become a thing?
We did it financially. We did it very cheaply. In fact, the key investor at the beginning of the whole thing was the Halifax Building Society, which refunded me my PPI that it had been overcharging me. And I thought, we can go and spend this on a big holiday, or it can be the seed money for the company, and that paid for studios and initial expenses and eventually got us off the ground. So the PPI scandal has actually produced one good thing, which is our podcast company. Like I say, the people that we have worked with, we'll pay you when we can. And they understood that it was being done. It was a flyer, really. It might have worked, it might not have worked. But luckily, we've got to a position where I think we pay quite competitively, actually. It's become core income for a lot of our presenters and our panelists, many of whom have found the river drying up in traditional media. Freelance budgets have gone right down in newspapers, magazines. They're barely there anymore. It's been a great way to take all that expertise and find new ways of using it. We found certain people like Dorian. I'd worked him for years as a writer, but he's really blossomed as a presenter. I had no idea that he'd turn out to be so good, and I'm really delighted that he has, and he's become a really good audio guy. And it's also just really refreshing, because I'm imagining another timeline where magazines hadn't collapsed and I was 30 years in the game and I was probably like the old guy who's run out of ideas. And it's really nice to be an entirely new frontier of media. You just start to feel inspired and energized again.
How do you launch a podcast like Romaniacs when you are yourself not part of a large media group? Presumably it's become easier now to launch these other new podcasts because you've built up the expertise and the listener base. But how did you launch Romaniacs then from the ground?
When we launched in 2017, podcasting hadn't developed quite so much as it had now. It was a little bit more of an open wild frontier. Now you do see quite a lot of the major companies, and not just major companies, but you'll see the top of the chart is usually quite crammed with recognizable faces. There's a kind of a Premier League approach, which is sign up the biggest name that you can, and you'll probably get a top five or a number one podcast. I'm not privy to the books there. I don't know how much money is going straight out the door after it's come in from advertising. But from our point of view, we're a proudly independent outfit. We're not part of any big company, and we watch our pennies very closely, and we're very aware that in podcasting, it's not like launching a magazine or a television program where instant success is required and it has to be very public. You have to be very visibly hitting the mark and bringing in the money. In podcasting, there's an opportunity to just grow your audience organically. To do it by word of mouth is the best marketing tool we've had, and we found launching our own podcasts that the best way to shift a new podcast is a recommendation on a podcast that you already like, which is why we now have a kind of a network effect through all of our podcasts. We could cross promote, and we also do a bit of a Marvel Cinematic Universe thing of having people do guest appearances from one podcast in another, crossover editions. But in terms of how do you launch one from a standing start, if you're not already where we are, I would say the great thing about the podcasting sector is there's a big lack of gatekeepers. So when I was in my magazine days, you spent your whole time worrying about W.H. Smith. You spent your whole time worrying about wholesale. You spent your whole time worrying about, could you get buy-in on the shelf? You weren't really thinking primarily. You're thinking about the reader all the time, but at the back of your mind is, I've got to get this past some sales guy who's got targets to meet. And with podcasting, it's, if you can launch with a compelling proposition, a compelling title, a tile that looks really unmissable, if you can build in a few other things, okay, it might be some celebrities who'd make it work, or it may be that you're going into a virgin sector that you've identified, then you can punch your weight with Global or the BBC or whomever. It's pretty meritocratic in that respect. So what we found is that the sector is really receptive to really good ideas. That might not be the case forever. It may be we as the sector matures and it gets more crowded, it may become necessary to employ in more of the kind of straightforward dark arts of marketing and so on. But so far, we've found that we're able to get a healthy listenership away, primarily by launching alongside pre-existing podcasts with a strong listenership, and just saying, you might like this, you might like this, you might like this. and it's worked so far.
How daunted were you, are you, by the fact that there are all these large media companies that, like you were saying, 2017, it wasn't so much of a developed sector in the UK, certainly. It was quite big in the US then, but the UK is really caught up now, and now every big media company, every big media brand wants in on podcasts. How does an indie company like yours survive and thrive with that level of competition?
I think, firstly, the arrival of the big brands has just helped grow podcasting anyway. So the more people listen to podcasts, the better for everybody. The more it just grows the universe of listeners. And I think podcasts are a bit like watching streaming television. After you've got into them, linear television just doesn't do it anymore. And I know this even from the most conservative media users I know are my parents. And for them, it's all Netflix and Amazon and Apple TV now. They barely watch the BBC, and they target BBC viewers. In terms of how do we compete with giant launch from a giant media conglomeration, we tend to build our shows as podcast only. And because we're not from an audio background, we don't have radio preconceptions, right? So a lot of what we see from big brands is really a radio show. Feels like a radio show. Sound design is like a radio show. The kind of view of the world is the thought that at the back of your mind, you're going to have to go to the travel. It tends not to go into the longer, deeper, and also more convivial, more team-based thing that makes a really good podcast tick. We realized pretty soon after launching Romaniacs that people were coming for the Brexit, because nobody else was talking what they were talking about, but they were actually staying for the team and the mix of people and the sense of humour and the fact that those people could say the things they can't say on the radio. We have political correspondents who can take an extremely definite angle on something. They can lose their temper and swear if they want, which the listeners quite like. So, you know, the fact that we are not coming at it, our background's not in radio, our background's not in here's how you make a half-hour radio show, here's how you make a running news show. We look at every idea fresh. We look at every format fresh. And that seems to give us a bit of standout in the very crowded app window, where you're in any category, you're looking at hundreds of options. And we've managed to express through our titles. But episode titles are really important. We put a lot of thought into that. The thing that I enjoyed most in the magazine was writing the headlines, because you could just compress so much meaning into a handful of words, into a clever pun, into a play on words. And we try to do that with the episode titles. And I see quite a lot of competitors don't. They tend to go for the straight SEO approach. And we found that our listeners really do like a kind of a characterful title, as well as a characterful team and a characterful set of ideas.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and I host the New Statesman podcast. Twice a week, we get under the skin of Westminster to help understand what's going on and what's going to happen next. We interview politicians, policymakers, and people on the front line to get you the full story behind the headlines. Plus, hear from our award-winning editorial team, including political editor Andrew Marr, to get to the bottom of what on earth is happening. Listen to the New Statesman podcast. You can subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
The BBC seems increasingly interested in podcasts, and it's an audio powerhouse already. And this is going back to my previous question in a way, but longer term, how can you or anybody else, frankly, compete with a behemoth like the BBC in audio?
This is the second time in my working career that I've seen the BBC behemoth effect in a market causing, I've got to say, problems. When I was in magazines, we would constantly have this issue of, it was a very weird period of my life when I was looking after smash hits, and I'm not a very smash hits guy, but it was on my desk. And at the end of every edition of Top of the Pops, which was then going, will be an advert for Top of the Pops magazine going out to then probably about 5 or 6 million viewers. And at the bottom of the screen, if you had an electron microscope, you could see the words, other music magazines are available. So Top of the Pops magazine had this insane, unfair advantage over smash hits. And I think Number One was still going then. And I'm not going to say it finished them off, but it certainly didn't help them, and it put them into a spiral from which they never really recovered. Similarly, other BBC magazines had this unfair advantage, which really put the independent sector on the back foot in a way that they simply couldn't compete with. I think we're getting to a similar point there with sounds, because for a lot of people who are maybe not as media adventurous as maybe others are, BBC Sounds is podcasting. It's the universe of podcasting. It's where all the podcasts are, and there aren't any other podcasts. It is advertised to them regularly on radio and television. It's pushed through the BBC website. It is the fact that the what was iPlayer Radio and Sounds have been merged, live streaming radio and podcasts and sort of listen again has all been merged into the one thing. So the BBC is very successfully creating a situation where it's the one stop for audio. But what that means is that independent broadcasting is disadvantaged. It means that people are going to expect from podcasting what they get from BBC Radio. Now, I'm a huge fan and a huge proponent of the BBC, and I think that what this government in particular has been trying to do to it is shameful, and I'm very much hoping that the next government reverses the decisions on the licence fee. That said, I don't think we're getting a fair crack of the whip in podcasting. I think there's a real danger that a lid will be put on the ability of independent podcasting to grow. And there is precedent for the BBC being compelled to support independent producers. We've seen BBC television compelled to use independent production companies to bring life to some of their existing properties, to very much on the Channel 4 publisher model, the original Channel 4 model, when it was Channel 4 won't make any programmes at all. It will simply commission and publish the productions of independent companies. I think there's an absolute case that Sounds ought to be opened up to independent podcasts, that you ought to be able to see Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart, or The Rest Is History, or Guardian Football Weekly, or our podcasts in the Sounds window, because that's where people are going. It's not really akin to, say, Radio 2 or BBC 3. It's akin to a newsstand. And if the BBC owns one of the biggest newsstands, not the biggest, Apple Podcasts and Spotify are bigger, but if the BBC owns one of the biggest newsstands in the country, why would it only sell BBC product?
Interesting. What's your favourite BBC podcast?
Well, actually, ironically enough, I enjoy the BBC for actual real-time radio more than it's podcasting. So I'll always listen to 6:06, the Today programme in the morning, although it sometimes drives me mad, is kind of part of my ritual. So the BBC is really good at real-time radio and reactive stuff and rolling news. For many of the things that are high on the podcast chart from the BBC are actually Listen Again for, say, Desert Island Discs or whatever. So, you know, that's absolutely fine, and that's where they should be. And I strongly believe that ultimately the BBC will be producing almost all of its non-news, non-live content for permanent catch-up. But that doesn't mean that they should have a monopoly on catch-up. We really need to be opening up Sounds to independent producers so that people get to see the full richness of the sector.
What are your favourite podcasts apart from your own?
My favourite podcast is the Slate Political Gabfest from Slate, which is basically my gateway drug to podcasting. That was the one that I'd been listening to it for years before we launched Big Mouth even. And I just thought it's still going and it's still really good because it's serious politics with a great sense of humour. It's like it's like sitting around the table in a pub or in a coffee shop with the smartest people, but also the most enjoyable people that you could hang out with. And we've certainly been strongly inspired, by what they're doing in many ways with Remainiacs. It was like, we should do something like that except with Brexit. And given the kind of massively polarised nature of American TV news and the incredibly sort of shrill pitch of it across the board, across the political spectrum, it's really pitched at screaming volume. Slate is actually pretty chilled and relaxed and can look at the madness of American politics certainly with a cool eye, but also with a really good sense of humour. But that will be my favourite.
What, in general, what makes for a good podcast? What are the traits that make up a good podcast, and what makes a bad podcast, would you say?
There are multiple kinds of good podcasts. The ones that we make depend heavily on the chemistry between the panelists and the interviewees and the anchor, because people essentially want to spend time with people that they like, who like things that they like and have interesting opinions. However, there are fantastic fully scripted podcasts. There are fantastic impressionistic podcasts. For me, the thing that unites them all, the really good ones, is that they're thinking about the listener first and they're imagining where the listener is when they're listening. So people tend to forget that podcasts are not just incredibly intimate, but they're very high attention products, right? You don't just wander into the kitchen, turn the radio on and wander off with a podcast. With broadcast radio, the key, whether it's music radio or speech radio, the key challenge is, for God's sake, don't let them turn over. People just listen in a totally different way with podcasts. You make an active decision. You put your earbuds in. You say, I've got to dedicate this time listening to this podcast. And often you'll build it into a part of your week. It'll be like, okay, in my case, Thursday nights is when I listen to a Slate Political podcast and cook the dinner. And I really, it adds value to otherwise fairly mundane time. So the really good podcasts understand that they've got to be the favorite thing of the week. You've got to look forward to Sunday morning, I'm walking the dog, my favorite podcast is out. And we see this across all of our podcasts, even the ones that we've brought in from elsewhere, like Steve Phillips' Rock and Roll Politics. His listeners are fanatical and they really look forward to it coming out. And if there's ever a glitch and it doesn't, they're on Twitter, go, where is it? So I think that's the thing that makes a really good podcast is understanding that somebody has made an active decision to listen to this and you need to reward it. You can't, my bugbear is podcasts that take 20 minutes to get started. When people say, hello, how was your trip to the studio? Oh, it was terrible. The bus broke down. Ha-ha, how's things? Hmm. What have you been up to at the weekend? Just get to the point. It surprises me how many kind of waffly podcasts there are out there. Podcasts, like I say, they add value to valueless time. And the very last thing you can do is be wasting that time that people have allotted to your stuff.
So podcasts have obviously grown in popularity. My parents recently started listening to them, which is new. What is that replacing in terms of people's time?
I think it's replacing passive media. I don't think they're listening to podcasts instead of doing something else. I think they're listening to podcasts instead of listening to filler media. I think they're replacing the kind of half turned down radio voice in the background in the kitchen that they're not really paying attention to. I think they're, in some respects, because the commute is a massive part of podcast listening, in some respects, it's replacing gazing out the window. In other respects, it is replacing reading a book or a paper on the bus. But it's also, podcasts are also getting themselves into time where media consumption didn't traditionally take place. Lots of people listen while running. I know people who listen while bathing the kids, and I'm not sure I would necessarily want the kids to listen to our podcasts with some of our presenters getting a bit worked up over certain things, but it does happen. So in terms of what's it replacing for the older listener, I think it's replacing less good stuff. Because as with streaming television, people have realised that you don't just have to watch what happens to be served up at 9 o'clock on a terrestrial channel, or even 9 o'clock on a satellite channel. You can go out there and really search out something of very high quality. It's a cliche to say we're in a golden age of television. I'm not sure that people are necessarily watching more television. They're just watching better television. And I think that's happening with audio as well. Because podcasts are so niche, you can find something that absolutely fits your interest. And yet that niche will be global, because all podcasts are available all around the world. You can find something that really delivers just even on your little tiny interest area.
Mm. In terms of revenues and the commercial viability of the sector, there's this PwC report that came out around a year ago, I think it was, that said that the UK podcast market would have ad revenues of £64 million by 2025, which sounds like a lot, but then it's not massive when you compare that with the US market and with some other areas of the media. What are you thinking there? I mean, advertising is presumably part of your revenue pie, as it were. How big is it compared with Patreon?
Well, that gave away too many intensely secret business things. They're both roughly equal importance to us, not because they're the same amount, but because we pay equal attention to them. Patreon is massively important because it's the direct relationship with the core listener, and it's a barometer of how you're doing. And we've been really glad to see that we've continued to grow our Patreons on all of the podcasts, even though Brexit happened, even though we failed in job one, stop Brexit, it didn't stop people supporting the podcast because they liked the podcast in its own right. So we put a lot of effort and thought into maintaining that because it's the most important relationship that we have. Advertising, however, grows, and we've been getting a lot of commercial reads. The thing would say, hello, this podcast is brought to you by such and such. And we've seen growth in those. We've seen growth in food and drink, in kind of medicine and mental health services, actually. It's been quite big. Finance, a lot of this it's like big, both big brands and also new launch insurgent brands are realizing that podcasts are very useful because they are high attention audio. Unlike most radio, which with the best will in the world can be fairly low attention audio, this is absolute intent listening. And also it's very trust-based. So if a presenter that you know and like and have a relationship with is endorsing something, that's quite a powerful and a useful thing. And we're pretty rigorous about what we will and won't endorse. We've had approaches from things that aren't quite right. We don't take betting ads because we don't really think it fits with our profile. But other things, we take adverts for beer and wine clubs because we use and endorse beer and wine and are big fans of it. And it's a good fit. In terms of the commercial growth potential, if Was that 64 million PricewaterhouseCoopers? Was that the figure?
Yeah.
That seems really low to me, because I'm not saying we're making 64 million a year, but we're just one company and we are doing pretty well to the extent that we're profitable and we're able to employ people. I would imagine that would grow quite a lot.
Interesting. And how many downloads do you get per month, week? What are your latest figures?
We are doing 1.6 to 1.7 million a month. We think 2 million is in sight. We've got some launch ideas coming up. We've also found it interesting to play around with the frequency, because daily podcasts, it turns out, are really powerful. People can build it into their routine and you can treat it almost as a channel. A weekly podcast is a program. A daily podcast is a channel featuring many individual programs on a single theme, plus you've got seven times the frequency for promotion, for cross-promotion, for advertising and so forth. So there's a lot of plasticity there, and you can develop some interesting things around it.
And final question, not based on science, but based on an observation that I made while looking through the podcast charts in the UK, which I know aren't always that reliable in some ways. But it seems to me that a lot of the podcasts that, especially in the news area, that do well and are popular, I like your podcasts and the news agents, and the rest is politics. And I'd say that those are reasonably, especially when you compare them with newspapers, which Press Gazette spends a lot of time thinking about newspapers, when you compare them with newspapers, they're reasonably left-leaning. Why is that? And is there a big market? Is there a big audience demand that's not being fed in podcasts for right-leaning podcasts? Where is the Daily Mail podcast?
Well, there are right-leaning podcasts. There's Planet Normal with Alison Pearson from The Telegraph. The strange thing, actually, is because the podcast chart is global, you will see an awful lot of right-wing podcasts, but they're all from America. It's all Ben Shapiro and people like that, which bleed across to ours. The chart algorithm is a strange one. It's not purely on listens. It's on rate of change and all that kind of stuff. I guess the main reason for that is that podcasts are a slightly younger medium, maybe, than print newspapers are. And you lean more liberal the younger you are. It could possibly also be because it's new. It's a new medium. And the adventurous minded tend to be more progressive. That said, James Dellingpole, I believe, has a podcast. There's Mog's podcast. There are a lot of right-wing podcasts out there. I think GB News seems to be doing quite a lot as well. And some of them perform well and some of them don't. The fact that the top end of the chart is perhaps populated by the woke toferati like us just indicates that perhaps forward-thinking people are more progressive and will engage with new things.
Thanks for that, Will. Fascinating interview. So what do you think were the big take-homes from it, and the big things that maybe other publishers can learn from that?
Big take-home is, give it a go. It's, as I said at the beginning, it is quite a... You don't have to invest too much money into a podcast to give it a go, at least. Hope, you know... We're not all Andrew Harrison. We can't all have big PPI payouts. I didn't get anything because I was a bit too young. But did you get much PPI payout? Can you remember?
I got loads. Yeah. I don't think I even took out any loans, but I applied for it and I seemed to get some money. So I'm not going to, certainly not going to turn it away.
Yeah, excellent. Anyway, I suppose the PPI scandal is behind us. Anyway, if you can get some money and you can afford to take a bit of a career break or just launch podcasts, then you should go for it, because you never know, you might end up with a huge success story. And it sounds like there's a lot of money in it, and possibly a lot more money than PwC made out in its report that came out around a year ago, at least according to Andrew Harrison's experience. I think what he was saying about the BBC was interesting and will certainly make a bit of a story on Press Gazette's website. Maybe I've listened to a podcast on BBC Sounds, but for me, it's not so much of an issue. It's not the only window out there. I think I first started listening to podcasts on Apple or Spotify, and I may have listened through BBC Sounds, but I think it's a really interesting area. And if he's saying that's an issue, then I think it's worth paying attention to.
I think he's right, because until relatively recently, I got nearly all my podcasts from BBC Sounds. A lot of people come to BBC Sounds as a way of listening to the radio or listening to radio programmes that they missed. And then you stumble across the podcasts as a consequence of that. And then the BBC's done, they've done thousands of podcasts. Yeah, I think that's a big issue. And the BBC is obviously very good at promoting its own podcasts. And I think that BBC Sounds app is like a bit of a blunderbuss in that market. It's sort of dominating it a bit. So I reckon he's got a fair point.
Area to watch.
What's your favourite podcast then at the moment, Will?
Oh, at the moment? I'd say I'm going to steal your answer and say The Rest Is History. Yeah, that is one of my favourite ones, to be honest, at the moment, because I feel like for GCSE history, I had to learn about the Industrial Revolution, which I found quite boring. Didn't get to see much of the war stuff. And I think after that, as a result, I thought, maybe I'm not that interested in history. But it's really rekindled my love for it. So I think that's really interesting. And I love lots of news podcasts. I think Tortoise do some really good podcasts. I loved Andrew Neil's interview podcast. I think that was one of my favourites. I listened to that around a year ago. How about you?
I think my favourite podcast that I've listened to is probably The Sun King, which was on Audible about Rupert Murdoch.
I remember you talking about that, yeah.
That's worth digging out if anyone can listen to that. I like another history podcast called You're Dead to Me on the BBC, which is like a more politically correct version of The Rest is History, but is still very good.
So you've changed your tune since last week when you were talking about how great The Rest is History is, specifically because it was unpolitically correct.
Yeah, no, that's not me. No. The one I'm listening to at the moment, A Very British Cult on the BBC, which is...
That's the most popular at the moment, I believe.
It's like an investigative journalism job, which is great. Podcast lends itself well to that. Yeah. And if I could have a mini moan about a BBC one, there's one I have listened to every episode of called Uncanny, which I've gone off it a bit because it's a podcast which is quasi-journalistic, ghost hunting.
Yeah, my mum told me about that one, yeah.
It's quite un-BBC, but I think they get away with it because it's a podcast, so it gets under the radar. But the conceit of it is, ooh, are ghosts real or aren't they? I don't know. And then this ghost hunter guy just goes around interviewing people, but he doesn't kick the tires of the stories. He's very happy to go along with this idea that ghosts are real and they are haunted.
But you've kind of sold it for me, actually. Might give it a go.
I think you have to ask who profits from those ghost stories. I think we've got lots to think about, lots to enjoy, and lots to hopefully put into practice on our own podcast as we continue to grow it. Thanks for listening to The Future of Media Explained with me, Press Gazette Editor-in-Chief Dominic Ponsford, joined this week by William Turville, Press Gazette's Associate Editor, and expertly produced by Adrian Bradley and May Robson. You can read more about the future of podcasts and all the other interesting themes about the future of media on pressgazette.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.